guidance as to where the virtues ought to be leading, any more than you can leave new converts without clear indications of which styles of behavior will in fact cohere with being in Christ, and which won't. Think, for example, of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. This could appear to be circular reasoning, seeing right actions as the things which stem from the virtues, and then seeing the virtues as the things which produce right actions, which is producing which. But that would be to flatten out what Paul is doing. He is engaged in active pastoral ministry, not simply in moral theorizing. And if he sees a car careening out of control, well off the track that faith, hope, and love should have been directing, he won't wait for the crash to happen, and lessons to be learned, if he can possibly help it. Stepping in with some firm rules, as for instance, in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and chapter 6, does not mean that he has given up inculcating virtue and is going back to rules, let alone to the law itself. Rather, he is displaying the skill of the pastor, knowing when to let the young pupil learn from mistakes made, and when to push the theory toward the back burner and go to the rescue. We could develop the driver-car-highway image in a different direction as well. I was driving the other day in a part of the country I know vaguely, but, as it turned out, insufficiently. The main highway was blocked by an accident, so I turned off onto a side road. Following my nose, I zigzagged across country lanes in roughly the right direction, but frequently came to turnings and junctions where there was no signpost. Obviously, the locals who use those roads know which way to go, but I, a comparative stranger, did not. I could have benefited from rules, signposts that said, in effect, this is the way, until the day when I had learned the road and didn't need them anymore. Experienced local drivers would only glance at such a sign, because, of course, they know already which way to go. Rules and virtue go together, but in a society where rules have often been perceived as arbitrary and restrictive, we need to remind ourselves how they should actually work, not so that we can rehabilitate an unthinking, keeping-the-rules mentality, but so that we can see, on a broad canvas, the truth which Paul highlights in Romans chapter 8, verse 3. What the law could not do, God has done. All this leads us to 2 other questions which are often asked about virtue, and to which Paul's virtue ethic offers clear answers. First, isn't it self-centered to shine the spotlight of moral discourse on the virtues that the individual is supposed to be cultivating? Isn't morality supposed to be about directing attention toward others? And second, doesn't a focus on virtue mean that the moral value of the individual is going to be determined to a large extent by accidents of birth, personality, nature, and nurture? No and no. Answering these 2 questions will draw us to the heart of what Paul says about the virtues and the 9-fold fruit. These characteristics are precisely generated by, and constitutive of, the life and work of an entire community, not of isolated individuals, and they are designed to contribute to that life and work, not to draw attention to the individual who is exercising them. And however much they are deliberately thought out, chosen, and practiced, they remain for the Christian the gift of God's grace. To explain this, we need first to broaden out the picture to include the 2 characteristics which Paul declares will last into God's new world alongside love: faith and hope. It's worth noting that this trio, found at the climax to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, regularly occur together in Paul, in letters normally regarded as both early and late. We remember before God our Father your work of faith, your labor of love, and your patient hope in our Lord Jesus Christ. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1 verse 3. We who are of the day should stay awake, and put on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet, the hope of salvation. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 verse 8. We have heard of your faith in Jesus Christ, and the love which you have for all the saints, through the hope which is stored up in you in the heavenly places. Colossians chapter 1 verses 4 and 5. 2 of these sentences are found in opening greetings, indicating that these are the categories for which Paul reaches when he wants to say, you are showing all the signs of being a healthy Christian community. It's interesting, too, that the passage from 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 is the passage we noted earlier, which says, we are daytime people, even though the world sleeps on. As in 1 Corinthians, then, the 3 virtues are to be found in an eschatological context. These are the things which belong to the new day that is dawning, and which you must make every effort to put on in the present time. But now a further puzzle appears. It may be clear that love is a virtue, in the sense of being an aspect of present hard-won discipleship, which genuinely anticipates the central feature of the life of the coming age. But how does this apply to faith and hope? Surely they are temporary, along with tongues, prophecy, and the other features of present Christian living, which we will do without in the age to come. One hymn puts it like this: Faith will vanish into sight, hope be emptied in delight, love in heaven will shine more bright, therefore give us love. This stanza comes from the 19th century hymn Gracious Spirit, Holy Ghost, by Bishop Christopher Wordsworth. This is the more surprising, in that Wordsworth was an expositor of the New Testament, and much of the hymn in question is directly drawn from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. But that chapter insists, as we have seen, that these three abide. They will last into the future world. Faith and hope will not vanish or be emptied. Why not? It is true that faith and hope do at present seem to us to be looking forward to the new age, so that we might assume that when the new age comes they will be redundant. But Paul is seeing much deeper than that. Faith is the settled, unwavering trust in the one true God, whom we have come to know in Jesus Christ. When we see him face to face, we shall not abandon that trust, but deepen it. Hope is the settled, unwavering confidence that this God will not leave us or forsake us, but will always have more in store for us than we could ask or think. I do not imagine for a minute that in the coming age we shall arrive at a point where we shall have experienced everything the new world has to offer, and will become bored, as is imagined by some scornful contemporary visions of heaven. That is a gross caricature born of the bland talk about heaven which has characterized afterlife speculation in the Western world over the last century or two. In contrast, because I believe that the God we know in Jesus is the God of utterly generous outflowing love, I believe that there will be no end to the new creation of this God, and that within the new age itself there will always be more to hope for, more to work for, more to celebrate. Learning to hope in the present time is learning not just to hope for a better place than we currently find ourselves in, but learning to trust the God who is and will remain the God of the future. So, back to the two objections. Is this virtue ethic actually self-centered, and does it lean too much on accidents of character given at birth? This brief analysis of faith and hope, and the more obvious analysis we could give of love, where love in the present is the anticipation of the mutual delight and affirmation that passes between God and his creatures, and between the creatures themselves, ought to be sufficient to answer the first of these. To speak of virtue is indeed to say that we are concerned with the moral growth, the habits of the heart, of every single individual. But to insist that the three primary virtues are faith, hope, and above all love, is to insist that to grow in these virtues is precisely to grow in looking away from oneself and toward God on the one hand and one's neighbor on the other. The more you cultivate these virtues, the less you will be thinking about yourself at all. We have here stumbled upon one of the most obvious differences between Christian virtue and that of the ancient pagans. Pagan virtue aimed at cultivating hero figures, brave, resourceful leaders, especially in war. Aristotle's ideal of virtue was, granted, developed within the context of the polis, the city-state, since, as he rightly saw, humans are social animals. But the virtues remain those of the individuals who stand out from the crowd. Christian virtue is, by definition, not like that. As we said earlier, it is a team sport, and it can be effective only when each member of the large and diverse team is playing his or her unique and distinctive part, in careful relation to every other member and for the good of the team as a whole. Is it paradoxical to say that cultivating virtue is a matter of looking away from yourself? If so, the paradox is only apparent, not real. Of course, morality must take root deep within the individual. To insist on that, as virtue does, is to insist that it is neither an externally imposed rule, nor a calculation of consequences that could in principle have been done by a computer, nor a matter of discovering what is in the depth of one's heart and being true to it. But if morality ends up coming to its focal point in faith, hope, and love, then, though it will spring from deep within, its actual focal point is outside the self, and in the God and the neighbor who are being loved, in the God who is the object of faith and hope, and the neighbor who is to be seen and loved in the light of that faith and that hope. Or to put it another way, at this point, even the words faith, hope, and love can let us down. The point of all three is not, look, here are three qualities I'm developing myself. To say that of faith, hope, and love is to perform a self-contradiction. All three, themselves gifts from God, point away from ourselves and outward. Faith, toward God and His action in Jesus Christ. Hope, toward God's future. Love, toward both God and our neighbor. The second objection was that a focus on virtue might appear arbitrary, in that some people seem to have the right sort of character as an accident of birth, or as the product of a particular upbringing. And of course there is apparent substance to this claim. Bill may appear to have a head start in some of the relevant areas, and that is not to be scorned. He grew up in a loving, supportive family, and was so much more likely to be outward-looking and generous than Ben, who grew up surrounded by selfishness, abuse, and violence. But Paul's answer would be, without a doubt, that this is beside the point when it comes to the Christian character of virtue. Those who belong to the Messiah Jesus crucified the flesh. There are no exceptions, no categories of people who can, as it were, slide sideways into the holiness which the gospel generates without going the painful route of crucifixion with the Messiah, and then the hard moral effort needed to cultivate the virtues in all their fullness. Think for a start of the number of areas of life covered by Paul's brief analysis of agape. Bill may well imagine that his background makes him a superior kind of being. Much is expected of those to whom much is given, and the deadliest snake of all, pride, is always lurking in the long grass, ready to bite those who fancy themselves effortlessly superior to their disadvantaged neighbors. Ben, glimpsing the difference between his background and the life of genuine Christianity, may take a flying and grateful leap into the new world. We come back to the question of being renewed in knowledge according to the image of the Creator. This is not a matter of preformed character, but of choices thought through, reasoned out, and implemented, of the new language learned, practiced, and spoken, at first stumblingly, and then gradually with increasing fluency. As with the virtues, so with the fruit of the Spirit. In fact, the closer we get to understanding the two categories, the more we realize that they are two ways of saying the same thing. We shall study the lists of virtues and spiritual fruit more fully in a moment, in search of their inner dynamic and practical outworkings, and we shall discover that Paul is simply coming at the same deep-level reality from different angles, in obedience to the rhetorical needs of the different context he is addressing. The point of using the term fruit, after all, is that these are things which grow from within rather than being imposed from without. Once we get over the common misperception that, if it is fruit, it ought to happen without our making any effort or thinking it through, actually any Christian with any self-awareness ought to realize the flaw in that quite quickly, then we are free to recognize that the different varieties of fruit are, like the virtues, characteristics that need to be thought through, chosen with an act of mind and will, and implemented with determination even when the emotions may be suggesting something quite different. That is how you acquire a taste or a skill. That is how you learn a language. That is how you are recreated as a fully human being reflecting God's image. That is how you become, in advance, part of the royal priesthood. That, after all, is where all this is going. Ultimately, God does not want, and Paul does not suppose that God wants, human beings as perfected individuals, all clean and scrubbed, but with nothing to do. Morality, surprisingly to some, is part of mission. Cleansed vessels are to be put to fresh use. Conversely, fresh use requires cleansing. But before we can explore this further, we must look at the corporate virtue, in which the virtues and the sorts of fruit come together. Paul insists that the church must be, must think of itself as, and must make every effort to remain, one body. 5. It isn't difficult, when you read Paul's lists of virtues and vices, to see one of the principal effects of following the one list or the other. Imagine living in a community where, day by day, the normal habit of life for most people includes immorality, bad temper, jealousy, factions, envy, and so on. Then imagine living in a community where, day by day, the normal habit of life is patience, kindness, gentleness, and self-control, not to mention love, joy, and peace. In one of C.S. Lewis's most memorable images, sketched in The Great Divorce, hell is a place where people live farther and farther apart from one another, since they are always quarreling and moving off somewhere else, muttering about how badly everyone else has behaved and how it's all someone else's fault. Of course, anyone with a bit of experience of the church knows that getting on with one another may sometimes be only skin deep. There are, sadly, plenty of communities which are outwardly very pleasant, but which, deep down inside, are pits of snakes. But the fact that many of us find the ideal hard to attain doesn't mean it isn't what we should aim at. In fact, our frustration when we meet that kind of split-level community, shining on the surface and rotten underneath, ought simply to increase our sense that the corporate virtue of unity is well worth working for. But work we shall have to do. Commands such as the following seem quite extraordinary and unreal to us today, and we have no reason to suppose that they were any easier in the first century. So if there is any comfort in the Messiah, if there is any consolation from love, if there is any partnership in the Spirit, if your hearts are at all moved with affection and mercy, then make my joy complete. Bring your thinking into line with one another in this way. Hold on to the same love. Bring your innermost lives into harmony with each other. Set your minds on the same object. Do nothing from selfish ambition or vanity, but in humility reckon each other as superior to yourselves. Don't look after your own interests, but each other's. Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. It's breathtaking, but it looks as though Paul really meant it. And it's not an optional extra, a further moral mountaintop for the intrepid few who have already climbed all the other peaks in the district and are looking for new challenges. This, you might say, is what Paul means by declaring that love is the virtue that binds all the others together. Colossians chapter 3, verse 14. This is love in action, or rather, it is the starting point for love in action. Unity of heart and mind among believers is only the beginning. From here, the gospel of active, generous love can go out into the rest of the world. There were, of course, particular pressures in the first century which made it vital that the Christians should cherish their unity. Persecutions came and went, but when the early Christians and their bizarre message met blank incomprehension, and when their gatherings aroused multiple suspicions of unpleasant, illicit rituals, were they really talking about eating someone? And worries about political subversion, were they really talking about another king? The followers of Jesus needed to stick closely together. Any divisions in the tiny little fellowships would be potentially disastrous, both for their internal health and for their external witness. One of the regular tragedies to this day among small groups of Christians who are faced with hostility from outside is how easily, addressing that threat, they turn their frustrations on one another in factional fighting within the community itself. And even when that doesn't happen, we who have lived for many generations with the phenomenon of denominations may well sigh and throw up our hands. Our denominations, with all their ambiguities and puzzles, are often rooted in the very kind of ethnic distinctions or personality-based divisions which Paul went out of his way to combat. Perhaps that is one reason why moral discussions in the church tend to go round and round in small circles on a few favored issues, especially sex, discussing how, why, and when two human beings come together in a loving or quasi-loving act may be, after all, a displacement activity when we can't cope with the question of how, why, and when a whole family of Christians should, but can't, come together in mutual love and support. That doesn't mean that sexual ethics are unimportant. On the contrary, they are symptomatic of the health or unhealth of the wider community. But we shouldn't focus all our worries on the fact that the church secretary has run off with the organist's spouse when the promised unity of Jesus Christ, with all his people, is flouted by structures and customs, and sometimes just theology, which destroy the fabric of the church just as surely as adultery destroys the fabric of the community. And we shouldn't concentrate all our attention on the fact that the church treasurer has embezzled $1,000, reprehensible though that is, when the entire banking system has crashed into chaos through the mind-blowing greed of those at the top. Personal morality is enormously important, but over-concentration on it can function as a displacement activity when we don't want to address the larger, equally important issues. Having said that, the two examples, of adultery and embezzlement, demonstrate the danger of allowing morality to be thought of solely in terms of rules, which are either obeyed or disobeyed. All right, the treasurer has taken money belonging to the church. But now that he has confessed, shouldn't we be gracious, not inform the police, remind ourselves that Jesus welcomes sinners and reinstate him? It's not that simple. What this fails to take into account is the extent to which the breaking of the rule against embezzling funds is far more than just cutting across an arbitrary injunction. It destroys trust. Will people give money to the church if they don't trust the treasurer? So too with adultery. How often one hears it said, when a couple has abandoned previous spouses and gotten together, that Jesus welcomes sinners, that one should be supportive, that we shouldn't be self-righteous or judgmental. This fails to take into account the way in which entire communities, villages, churches, colleges, businesses, you name it, suffer a kind of moral electric shock when two people who have publicly committed themselves elsewhere suddenly turn out to be an item. It isn't just that they have broken a rule. They have undermined part of the moral fabric of their world. The command to be united, then, is worked out by Paul in sharp focus and detail. The passage from Philippians, with which we began, comes at it from one angle after another. Learning to think the same way as each other, learning to love one another in the same way, practicing a harmony of thought and feeling, uniting in the object of thought. How many more ways, we wonder, can Paul say the same thing? And he places these extraordinary commands within a framework which itself speaks volumes. Comfort, consolation, partnership, affection, mercy, and joy. If there is any sign of any of these, that is the place to start. Any Christian fellowship that lacks these is hardly a Christian fellowship. And when you see the spark of any of them, like the small glow at the back of the fireplace, blow gently and bring it into a small flame, then feed the flame with more fuel until the whole fire comes to life. That's how it's done. And then at the other side of the picture, whenever you find selfish ambition or vanity, you know that's the wrong way to go. Whenever you find yourself thinking you're superior, learn the habit of pushing the thought away. Remember Mark Baxter, the father who, by acting quickly, saved his young daughter from drowning? Every time I thought a bad thought, I forced myself to think of something else. Whenever you find yourself looking after number one, stop and think, and find a way of reversing that priority. Philippians chapter 2 is all about looking away from yourself and concentrating on everybody else. Yes, I know. Someone is already saying to herself, okay, so Paul thinks we should be doormats for Jesus. I used to be like that, and everyone just walked over me. Now I've learned that if you don't stand up for yourself, you'll be used and abused. That is the normal critique of what is taken to be a Christian ethic. You will find it in plenty of places, both inside and outside the church. But it's a critique of a parody, not of the reality. Many modern Christians have become so used to taking Paul's commands with a large pinch of salt that these instructions have lingered on, like the grin of the Cheshire Cat, in debased forms, the simpering pseudo-humility of Anthony Trollope's character, Mr. Slope, and the self-hatred of those who, for whatever reason, are always putting themselves down and pretending to themselves that by so doing, they are following Jesus and Paul. We are less accustomed, perhaps, to recognizing the robust, cheerful community where genuine mutual submission goes hand in hand with, and indeed creates a supportive context for, energetic exercising and celebrating of individual gifts, including strong and wise leadership. Happily, such communities do exist, and where they do, they are a joy. Actually, as with all virtues, once you begin to learn the language, and especially once you begin to speak it in groups where other people are learning it too, it doesn't seem so impossible, but actually begins to acquire its own sense of second nature, of a second-order spontaneity, as with skilled actors, footballers, or jazz players who have learned the high art of true corporate improvisation. Sadly, we have all too often settled for the instant spontaneity of everyone doing what comes naturally, with strong leaders bullying their way through, organizations lurching from tyranny to chaos and back again, and those within them who feel cowed into submission hiding behind the hope that maybe they're being humble. All this is, again, an unpleasant parody of what Paul has in mind. Paul's longest, most sustained appeal for unity is the letter we call 1 Corinthians. The whole letter is a lesson in the habits of mind and heart necessary to attain and maintain a rich, diverse unity. This again isn't a matter of rules, though as we have seen, rules may be a good way of pointing people in the right direction and enabling them to check that they're still on track. Rather, it's a matter of learning to think and act in accordance with the Spirit of Jesus Christ in such a way that the things which harm unity are spotted early on and rooted out. Personality cults, sexual immorality, lawsuits, disputes over cultural differences, flirting with pagan practices, a rich-poor divide, especially when it impinges on the Lord's Supper, pride or jealousy over different spiritual gifts, chaotic worship, losing a grip on the heart of the gospel. That just about sums up 1 Corinthians, and at every point Paul is seeking to introduce the habits of corporate life necessary to sort it all out, as well as the theological teaching which will undergird it all, particularly the upside-down wisdom of the cross. This permeates a good deal of the letter from the very beginning, and the spectacular hope of the resurrection, which, it gradually becomes clear, dominates one topic after another until its full statement in chapter 15. Of course, 1 Corinthians wasn't the end of the story. 2 Corinthians tells us, sharply and poignantly, that it all went horribly wrong, and that Paul himself had to model the self-abasing pattern of the cross in order to re-establish the church in Corinth, and his apostolic relationship to it, on the basis of Jesus Christ himself crucified and risen. That shows all too clearly that the habits of the heart are not easy to learn, and that every Christian community and every Christian leader is called to learn them more and more deeply. It also shows that, whether or not people are learning those habits, circumstances may very well push them in a direction where they are forced either to do so more deeply or to lose the plot entirely. Anyway, it is within this complex of pastoral and theological issues that we find one of Paul's greatest statements on the unity of the one body of believers. Having challenged his readers at the start of the letter, chapter 1, verse 13, as to whether Christ himself was divided, as their own divisions would imply, and having warned against those who destroy the unity of the church, which is, after all, God's new temple, chapter 3, verses 16 and 17, he returns to the theme as the letter slowly builds to its climax. As the body is one, with many members, so it is with the Messiah. 6. The most obvious mistake to make, as we read Paul's description of the church as the body of the Messiah, in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, is to suppose that the image of a human body is simply a convenient metaphor plucked at random to make the point about diversity of gifts and unity of purpose. From that point of view, he might as well have described an elephant, whose body contains even more diverse bits and pieces, or a ship's crew with their different functions, or indeed a car, or right in his world a chariot. There were many other ways in which the diversity in unity and the unity in diversity could have been articulated. Why a human body? Well, for a start, Jesus the Messiah was and is a human being. It's appropriate to think of those who belong to him in the same way, but that answer only scratches the surface. The real answer, as we find elsewhere in this letter and elsewhere in Paul's writings, is rooted in his vision of the church precisely as the renewed, redeemed humankind. There is an appropriateness about this metaphor, or if you like, this is not only metaphor, but also metonymy. The construction and proper operation of a new way of being human is exactly what it's all about. A human body isn't just an illustration drawn at random. It's a signpost directly into the heart of what's going on. The particular issue at stake is that of spiritual gifts, tongues, prophecy, special words of knowledge, particular sudden gifts of special faith, and so on. Paul will declare in the next chapter that these things are nothing without love, and that they will be abolished while love will go on. That is part of the point of the present chapter as well. Don't worry so much about which gift you have or haven't been given, but recognize that all the gifts come from the same source. Chapter 12, verses 4 through 11. And are mutually interdependent, just like the foot, the hand, and the eye. Chapter 12, verses 14 through 26. The challenge to live as a single body is the challenge to live as the new human. When the Spirit of Jesus the Messiah comes to dwell in Christians, individually and corporately, this happens so that they can be, altogether, the place where his genuinely human life actually and physically continues within the life of the present world. No wonder the unity of the church is so contested and difficult to maintain, whether in Corinth in the first century or in the confused world of the 21st. No wonder there are so many low-grade parodies of this unity, both in the forced conformism of ecclesial totalitarianism and the forced agility of the like-minded small group. Both of these are ways of avoiding the real challenge, which is to allow the central Christian virtues of faith, hope, and love, and the fruit of the Spirit, which is love, joy, peace, great-heartedness, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control, to have free course in our relationships with one another, and to discover, as they work their way into our lives, the corporate virtues of mutual submission and mutual recognition of God-given gifts of leadership, teaching, and so on. That is precisely what Paul insists on in another passage that deserves to stand beside 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Here in Ephesians chapter 4 verses 1 through 16, it becomes apparent that the unity for which Christians must work is not merely pragmatic, a recognition of differences in which we all shrug our shoulders, do our own thing, and allow other people to do theirs, but a deep, rich, many-sided unity which enables the church to grow toward maturity, leaving behind, as in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, but now as a present task, the immature babyhood which might otherwise remain as a permanent and vulnerable state. So then, this is my appeal to you. Yes, it's me, the prisoner in the Lord. You must live up to the calling you received. Bear with one another in love. Be humble, meek, and patient with each other in all your thinking. Make every effort to guard the unity that the Spirit gives, with your lives bound together in peace. There is one body and one Spirit. You were, after all, called to a single hope which goes with your call. There is one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all, through all, and in all. But grace was given to each of us, according to the measure the Messiah used when he was distributing gifts. That's why it says, when he went up on high, he led bondage itself into bondage, and he gave gifts to human beings. When it says here that he went up, what this means is that he also came down into the lower place, that is the earth. The one who came down is the one who also went up, yes, above all the heavens, so that he might fill all things. So these were the gifts that he gave. Some were to be apostles, others prophets, others evangelists, and others pastors and teachers. Their job is to give God's people the equipment they need for their work of service, and so to build up the Messiah's body. The purpose of this is that we should all reach unity in our belief and loyalty, and in knowing God's Son. Then we shall have a mature and genuine human life, measured by the standards of the Messiah's fullness. As a result, we won't be babies any longer. We won't be thrown this way and that on a stormy sea, blown about by every gust of teaching, by human tricksters, by their cunning and deceitful scheming. Instead, we must speak the truth in love and so grow up in everything into him, that is, into the Messiah, who is the head. He supplies the growth that the whole body needs, linked as it is and held together by every joint which supports it, with each member doing its own proper work. Then the body builds itself up in love. There is so much detail here that we might get bogged down. Let me highlight the key elements for our present purposes. First, this majestic passage stands four square on what Paul has said earlier in Ephesians, and tracking this sequence of thought will make it clear what purpose he supposes this hard-won virtue of unity will serve. Chapter 1 concludes with the statement of Jesus' present position as the one spoken of in Psalms 2, 8, and 110. The Messiah, who is also the new human, God has put all things under his feet, making him sovereign over every other authority, power, dominion, and name. Chapter 1, verse 22, chapter 21. But this is not simply a matter for Christians to celebrate. They are to share in this identity. God has put all things under his feet, and has given him to the church as the head over all. The church is his body. It is the fullness of the one who fills all in all. Chapter 1, verse 22 and 23. Here is the to and fro, the paradox we noted earlier in the connection with the temple. The living God fills heaven and earth, and yet he chooses to dwell particularly in one place. And that place is no longer a building, in Jerusalem or anywhere else. It is a family, the family of those who belong to the Messiah. They are the living expression of the fact that he is the world's rightful sovereign, the royal community of the king. But if they are the royal community, they are also the priestly community, as the notion of priesthood and that of the temple come together at the end of Ephesians chapter 2. You are no longer foreigners or strangers. No, you are fellow citizens with God's holy people. You are members of God's household. You are built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with King Jesus himself as the cornerstone. In him the whole building is fitted together and grows into a holy temple in the Lord. You too are being built up together, in him, into a place where God will live by the Spirit. chapter 2, verses 19 through 22. How easy it has been for Western Christians to forget this vocation altogether. It has helped that many have suggested Paul didn't write Ephesians, a claim that has called the letter's authority into question. That, I believe, was originally at least in part a tactical move to justify abandoning this breathtaking and demanding vision. Or if we don't forget this vocation, we domesticate it by speaking in exalted terms of the church, pretending, for instance, that the label church refers only to the ultimate eschatological or heavenly community, while retreating into subgroups and sub-subgroups where we can maintain an appearance of unity without any of the work or the cost. But virtue is always the result of work and cost. Paul's appeal for unity, in chapter 2, the unity of Jews and Gentiles within the one church, in chapter 4, the unity of all Christians with their enormously varied ministries, is nothing if not an appeal for virtue. Here, he declares, is the goal. Mature humanity, chapter 4, verse 13, growing esandra teleon, into a perfect human, measured by the standards of the Messiah's fullness. And here are the things which you must work at. They don't happen by accident. They happen because people who might well have done it differently, left to themselves, have made the clear-eyed choice to make every effort, chapter 4, verse 3, to cultivate the multiple virtues which together contribute to that maturity. The wide range of different ministries which God gives to his church is meant not to pull the church apart in pursuit of every new personality or initiative that comes along, but to build up the Messiah's body, to enable it to grow into a rich, diverse unity. Every single Christian is to exhibit the virtues. Every single Christian is to be obedient to his or her unique, distinctive, unrepeatable vocation. There lies the challenge. Here again, as with the cultivation of the fruit of the Spirit, there are powerful forces driving us in the opposite direction, toward false teaching, trickery and deceit, verse 14. That is why, to repeat, unity is a virtue, the corporate virtue in which the very different members of the body grow up in everything into him, who is the head, the Messiah. And of course, as with the three virtues in the ninefold fruit, the key to the one body is love, verse 16. Copy God, Paul urges at the end of the next passage, like loving children imitating your father. Here, unusually but very strikingly, Paul urges his hearers not only to reflect on God's love, but to look and see how it's done and then do it themselves. Conduct yourselves in love, he continues, just as the Messiah loved us and gave himself for us, as a sweet-smelling offering and sacrifice to God. Chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. This is what royal priesthood looks like in the present time. A community that together learns the lessons of holiness, chapter 4, verse 17 through chapter 5, verse 20, and that learns as well what it means to reflect God's character and actions to one another. The challenge to strive for corporate virtues is, after all, precisely what we should expect if the key individual virtue and the first fruit of the Spirit is love. The thought of two or three Christians, or 200 or 300 or 1,000 Christians, all trying to practice love, while remaining determinedly in their own hermetically sealed worlds of private spirituality and virtue, is of course a contradiction in terms. The Christian virtues, unlike the classical or cardinal virtues expounded by Aristotle and others, are designed to produce not grand isolated heroes, leading a nation in politics and war, but integrated communities modeling a life of self-giving love. With that, we glimpse a truth which I hinted at near the start of this book and must now return to explore. If the Christian community is genuinely learning the corporate virtues required for a multifaceted unity, then this has, in and of itself, an apologetic value over and above that of simple difference. Fancy that, those Christians are living in quite a different way from the rest of us. An attractiveness. Well, but their way of living looks really good. Precisely because the Christian virtues look upward to the God who made the whole world and made all people in his image, and outward to that world and all people within it, they cannot be the private preserve of an enclosed community. It isn't a matter of turning our back on the great traditions of virtue developed by pagan and non-Christian philosophers down the centuries. It should be a matter of demonstrating that what we were striving for is fully comprehended within, but also transcended by, this new vision of virtue, which is a vision of Jesus Christ himself. This can't be, then, merely a matter of adding a few new virtues to a lengthening list, or even of insisting that these new ones are more important. With the addition of the Christian virtues and their privileging, something has happened to virtue itself, something which points us to the very heart of the challenge which the Christian faith offered, and must still offer, to the world around. Here, these virtues declare, is the new way of being human, not only some new and previously unheard of virtues, but a new definition of virtue itself, a whole new way of humanity which offers itself as the genuine article to a surprised and suspicious world. Does this, or does it not, commend itself? Thus the one unified body of Christ, striving after the virtues and working hard to bring forth the fruit of the Spirit, must be the missionary body which sets forward the purpose of God, to sum up all things in heaven and on earth in the Messiah. That is what it means in the present time to live as the royal priesthood. Chapter 7. Virtue in Action, the Royal Priesthood. 1. There are, no doubt, many avenues of inquiry that now open up before us. Whole worlds of moral and ethical investigation invite fresh exploration. But this book isn't the place for that. What I want to do, to push home the main point I have been making throughout, is to show what it means to develop the virtues in the present time, which genuinely anticipate those of the royal priesthood. We are designed to be, in the end, fully renewed, image-bearing human beings. What will be the character strengths that go to make up that kind of life, and how can we develop them here and now? These, rather than the details of ethical or moral questions on the one hand, or the fine-tuned study of character traits on the other, constitute the big picture which we must set out. The present chapter will therefore address three questions, each of which will be spread over two sections. First, what does it mean in the present to behave as the royal priesthood, and what are the habits of heart, mind, and life which contribute to that? Second, how does this vocation not only engage the wider world by holding before it a vision of a new way of being human, but also visibly upstage the classical and modern tradition of a secular virtue ethic, retaining the best emphases within that tradition by transforming them within the new framework? Third, how does this larger vocation give shape and body to the particular habits which generate specifically Christian behavior and help us to avoid specifically pagan behavior? How, in other words, does following Jesus in the vocation to royal priesthood both necessitate and generate a life of genuine Christian holiness? The first of these questions grows directly out of the study we have made of key parts of the Bible. We have seen that the command of humanity in Genesis chapter 1 and the promise of renewed humanity in the New Testament both highlight the dual vocation to be rulers and priests. This, I suggest, is the vocation that shapes the Church's two primary tasks, worship and mission. Worship and mission are conjoined twins. They share a heart, the heart that loves God, the triune Creator, and that loves, for His sake, the world He made, and particularly, the creatures that bear His image. This is the heart that can be trained in the practice of virtue. The frustrating thing, when you recognize this, is to realize how many people regularly attend the training ground, but do not take part in the training itself. Take worship first. To worship the living God, the God we know as Father, Son, and Spirit, is to give voice to our faith, to celebrate our hope, and above all to express and articulate our love. Just as a man in love will enumerate to his beloved the 101 things about her that he finds so delightful, so Christian worship consciously stands in the presence of the living God and declares who He is and what He's done that has so swept us off our feet. Just as a couple in love will go back over the story of their first acquaintance, courtship and mutual discovery, telling and retelling the narrative of how it all happened, so the worshipping heart will naturally want to tell and retell the story of God and the world, of God and Israel, of God and Jesus, of God and one's own personal story. This is a major element in Christian worship. Notice that I said that these things happen naturally at first. What happens when they are left that way? The answer is all around us in the contemporary or even postmodern Western Church, which has somehow got stuck with a romantic picture of falling in love with Jesus or having Jesus as my boyfriend. That's fine as far as it goes. The Bible and significant strands in both Jewish and Christian devotion have expressed the worship of God in language taken directly from the romantic and indeed erotic relationship of two human lovers. But as all romantic and erotic lovers know, things don't keep their initial buzz. And, as I've constantly had to say to puzzled young people exploring love, sex, and marriage, the excitement of romance is like the excitement of striking a match. It's sudden, sparky, and dramatic, and it doesn't last long. The question is, what are you going to do with the match once you've struck it? The answer, which has obvious resonances with Christian worship beyond the metaphorical meaning, is that you will use the match to light a candle. A candle isn't as exciting as a match, at least to begin with, but it can be far more beautiful, far more evocative, and far more long-lasting. Human couples need to learn that lesson, to prevent them from supposing that when the match goes out, something has gone dramatically wrong and they must look for another match to strike as soon as possible. To learn this, indeed, is part of the road to the virtue of chastity. In the same way, those who have found their hearts warmed with the love of God need to learn that the virtues of faith, hope, and love, as expressed in worship, are to be worked at, thought through, figured out, and then planned, prepared, and celebrated with a new depth that will stir passions which the matches of quick romantic attraction could not reach. Just as the couple preparing to celebrate their 40th wedding anniversary may well take considerable thought over what to do and how to do it, so that both partners will receive the maximum delight from the occasion, so the church that cherishes a mature, deep, and long-lasting love for God will want to think carefully about how to worship Him, not because that worship isn't coming naturally, but because what they're interested in is the second nature, the developed and sustained virtues of a love that has thought through why it is worshiping this God and has figured out ways of doing so which express that deeply and richly. That, of course, is the difference between liturgy and spontaneous worship. There is nothing wrong with spontaneous worship, just as there's nothing wrong with two friends meeting by chance, grabbing a sandwich from a shop, and going off together for an impromptu picnic. But if the friends get to know one another better and decide to meet more regularly, they might decide that, though they could indeed repeat the picnic from time to time, a better setting for their friendship and a way of showing that friendship in action might be to take thought over proper meals for one another and prepare thoroughly. In the same way, good Christian liturgy is friendship in action, love taking thought, the covenant relationship between God and His people not simply discovered and celebrated like the sudden meeting of friends, exciting and worthwhile though that is, but thought through and relished, planned and prepared, an ultimately better way for the relationship to grow and at the same time a way of demonstrating what the relationship is all about. In particular, Christian worship is all about the church celebrating God's mighty acts, the acts of creation and covenant, followed by the acts of new creation and new covenant. The church needs constantly to learn and constantly to be working on the practice of telling and retelling the great stories of the world and Israel, especially the creation and the Exodus, the great promises that emerged from those stories, and the ways in which those promises came to their fruition in Jesus Christ. The reading of Scripture, the written account of those stories, has therefore always been central to the church's worship. It isn't only that people need to be reminded what the stories say, though that is increasingly important in an age where otherwise educated people simply don't know the Jewish and Christian stories at all. It's that these stories should be rehearsed in acts of celebration and worship, telling out the greatness of the Lord, as Mary sang in the Magnificat. Good liturgy uses tried and tested ways of making sure that Scripture is read thoroughly and clearly, and is constantly on the lookout for ways of doing it even more effectively, just as good liturgy is also eager to discover better and better ways of singing and praying the Psalms together, so that they come to be second nature within the memory, imagination, and spirituality of all the worshipping faithful, not just of a few musically minded leaders. It's interesting to study the scriptural account of the early church at worship in the Acts of the Apostles, which describes the first Christians drawing on the Psalms and other scriptures to celebrate God's love and power and to be strengthened and sustained in mission. Because the early Christians were attempting to live as the true temple, filled with the Spirit, we ought not to be surprised that the major confrontations they incurred were the existing temples and their guardians, the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, and the whole culture of pagan temples in Athens and elsewhere. That's what you'd expect if a new royal priesthood was being called into existence. In particular, of course, a church that is learning the habits of the royal priesthood will celebrate the sacraments, those occasions when the life of heaven intersects mysteriously with the life of earth, not so that earth can control or manipulate heaven, that would be magic, not faith, but so that the story of heaven may become concrete, physical reality within the life of earth, catching up human beings within a world where all sorts of things make sense that don't otherwise, and all sorts of other things that might have appeared to make sense do so no longer. All of this life of worship is something to be learned. Communities can grow into liturgy and the sacraments, and can take delight in discovering that these things can become, as it were, habits of the community's heart as well as of the individuals. Shared worship is part of what it means when we compare Christianity to a team sport. It is together that we are God's people, not as isolated individuals. That being togetherness does not, of course, mean uniformity. What counts is precisely the coming together of people who are quite unlike one another in everything except their commitment to the God we know in Scripture and ultimately in Jesus. That unlikeness carries forward into the multiple vocations to which God calls us, vocations which, as we saw in the previous chapter, are nevertheless designed as gifts to enable the whole community to grow to a mature unity. And it is precisely in shared worship that this differentiated unity is expressed and learned. This is where, ironically, we meet the opposite objection to the one we met earlier. The normal Protestant objection to virtue, as we've seen, is that it's just hypocrisy, putting it on when you don't yet fully mean it. The standard answer is that this is the only way to acquire the deep-rooted characteristics of faith, hope, love, and all the rest. If we wait to start practicing these things until we mean them from the bottom of our hearts, we will wait a long time and probably mess up a lot of lives, including our own, in the process. But now we face the opposite problem. The charge that liturgy and other aspects of formal worship have become just a habit, implying that because worship is a habit, you don't really mean it. At one level, the two charges cancel one another out. If you're just putting it on, it isn't a habit. If it's a habit, you're not just putting it on. But there's a serious point underneath this second problem. Virtue, whether individual or corporate, is never something that can be taken for granted. Once the habit is formed, by many conscious choices and decisions, it has to be maintained in good running order. Here is the difference between authenticity and spontaneity. Spontaneity objects to all habits. Things ought just to happen. Authenticity, on the other hand, doesn't mind habits, so long as they don't become hollow. Fair enough. It would be good, frankly, to think that many of today's Christians were anywhere near the danger of forming habits of worship so strong that they could become just a habit. That is perhaps a problem that is dying out. But if and when the danger is present, the warning is justified. When human beings worship God the Creator, articulating their praise and adoration because of who He is and what He's done, they are, whether or not they realize it, summing up the praises and adoration of the whole creation. That is another reason why the physical expression of worship, in liturgy and especially in the sacraments, remains important. We shouldn't expect to worship as disembodied souls who happen to be temporarily resident in these strange things called physical bodies, and then to be able to do our job as God's royal priesthood, picking up creation's praises and presenting them before God's throne. Remember, that is what we are called to do and to be. Don't be surprised if the body language of worshippers expresses something of what is being said and done. No doubt this too can become a hollowed-out habit, to be challenged from time to time in the name of authenticity. But to frown on the physical expression of worship, gestures of hand and arm, of head and knee, whatever, as though all such things were signs of hypocrisy or the attempt to put God in our debt, would be as ridiculous as to suppose that such expressions were all that was required, without the devotion of the heart and mind. As we have seen frequently in this book, the church is called to be the new temple, the place where the living God dwells by the Spirit. This is a whole person vocation. The life of worship, then, is itself a corporate form of virtue. It expresses and in turn reinforces the faith, hope, and love which are themselves the key Christian virtues. From this activity, there flow all kinds of other things in terms of Christian life and witness. But worship is central, basic, and in the best sense, habit-forming. Every serious Christian should work at having worship become second nature. Expressing the love of God in this way will then flow naturally across from the first conjoined twin to the second, reinforcing the life of mission. The temple is there because God's filling of the house with his presence is to be a means, as well as a sign, that God intends to fill the whole world with his glory. Worship must lead to mission. The priests are also royal. 2. If you want to see what it looks like for God's renewed people in Christ to be royal, to be rulers in the sense indicated by the vocation to be a royal priesthood, don't look at the 4th and 5th centuries, when the Roman emperors first became Christian. That raises questions and challenges at other levels, but to begin there would be to miss the point. Look instead at what the church was doing in the first 2 or 3 centuries, while being persecuted and harried by the authorities, and announcing to the whole world that Jesus, the crucified and risen Messiah of Israel, was its rightful Lord. That is what it means to be rulers, in the sense we're discussing here, to be agents of that king's reign, the reign of the Prince of Peace, the one through whom tyranny itself, not to mention any individual tyrants, was overthrown with the destruction of its most vital weapon, namely death, and the one through whom therefore was brought to birth a new world in which order and freedom at last meet. We shouldn't forget that death is the last weapon, not only of the tyrant, but also of the anarchist. Look particularly at the Acts of the Apostles, where the church is explicitly commanded by the risen Lord himself to witness to him as king and to the reality of his kingdom. Acts chapter 1, verses 7 and 8. The community that lives as the renewed temple is also to live as the rulers in waiting, as people who can declare that they must obey God rather than human authorities. Acts chapter 4, verse 19, chapter 5, verse 29. Those early Christians were not disobeying the laws of the land. They were merely giving allegiance to the God who had revealed himself in a fresh way. This must have been particularly frustrating, of course, for those traditional Jews who thought they were the divinely appointed channels of God's wise order. Jesus' followers will continue to serve the God of their ancestors and to tell the story of his mighty work, but they will tell this story with a different climax, as, for instance, in Acts chapter 7 and chapter 13. Instead of the story's climax coming with the presence of the high priest in the temple, as expressed in the book called Ben Sira or Ecclesiasticus, written around 200 BC, or with the coming of a future warrior messiah who would lead the armies of Israel in a mighty battle against the Romans, as the Essenes seem to have hoped, or with the intensified keeping of Israel's ancestral law, as the Pharisees had wanted. The climax would be Jesus himself, the true king, rejected but now exalted, claiming a divinely given sovereignty of which the apostles were the witnesses and agents. And this sovereignty would not stop with Israel. Already in those early centuries, it spread throughout the world, in one paradoxical confrontation after another. Paul and his companions reminded magistrates of their duty under Roman law, Acts chapter 16 verses 35 through 40, confronted the most famous pagan court in the Greco-Roman world, Acts chapter 17 verses 22 through 34, gained a favorable verdict before Seneca's adopted brother Gallio, and an implicit vindication from the town clerk in Ephesus, Acts chapter 18 verses 12 through 17, chapter 19 verses 35 through 41, reminded a Roman tribune of his legal position, chapter 22 verses 25 through 29, announced God's coming judgment to one Roman governor and his present legal standing to another, chapter 24 verses 25 through 26, chapter 25 verses 6 through 12, and ended by using his Roman citizenship to gain a safe passage to Rome, to which he had long believed God intended him to go to announce God as King and Jesus as Lord, chapter 25 verse 11, chapter 28 verses 30 through 31, Romans chapter 1 verses 13 through 15. This is one part at least of what it means to be rulers, calling the world's rulers to account before Jesus for their proper performance of their subordinate duties. More particularly, the early Christians were becoming the agents of God's sovereign rule through their work in announcing Jesus as Lord. As they did this, and as the power of the gospel transformed people's hearts and lives, they saw communities spring up that gave allegiance to Jesus and celebrated his lordship. Celebrate in the Lord always, Paul exhorted them. I'll say it again, celebrate. The Lord is right here, near at hand. Philippians chapter 4 verses 4 and 5. These communities, though not of course without the many problems which we glimpse in the mirror of Paul's correspondence, were not least communities of mutual love and support, Communities in which people welcomed one another across the traditional boundaries of race, gender, and class, and looked out for one another's needs, taking special care of the poor. They were the communities, in other words, in whom Jesus' challenge to the rich young man in Mark chapter 10 were being fulfilled, as people pooled their resources in order to look after those who had made common cause with Jesus and his people. Acts chapter 2 verses 43 through 47, chapter 4 verses 32 through 37.